Hello, and welcome to Old News. My name's David.
And I'm Russell. It's good to be back.
Oh, I was just going to say it.
It's steal my lines. How dare you?
I don't know why we're falling into that particular thing.
Well, I guess familiarity. So, how's things?
Well, I took my car to get serviced on Saturday and spent most of the day just lazing around Newcastle.
There are worse things to do and worse places to be.
Well, I suppose, yeah. It was interesting being around Grey's Monument. There was a surprisingly good ska band.
Right.
Surprising because just the words ska band and good don't go together in my book on the whole.
Okay, fair enough.
But they were surprisingly good. There was the usual Socialist Workers Party people.
Oh, yeah. Heinz 57 variety of hard left politics.
There was.
Yeah.
There was a few different ones of them. Yeah. There was some Muslim evangelists, if that's the right term.
Were Friends of Palestine there?
Yes, Friends of Palestine were there. There was the usual Christian evangelist.
Right.
Shouting at people.
That's interesting that that's really turned into a proper speaker's corner.
Yeah. And there was also a man dressed as a monk with a V for Vendetta mask.
Oh, is that the Guy Fawkes mask? Yeah.
Holding a placard saying capitalism is dead. So he was obviously one of the many forms of left-wing politics.
Uh-huh.
But I particularly enjoyed the monk mask combo.
Was he actually doing anything, or was he just there
He was just there. He wasn't with the others. He was an independent left winger, but yeah, he was just wandering about with his mask and his
robes
and his placard.
That's just bizarre.
Yeah,
that's very strange. That reminds me of, I remember many moons ago there was an interview with David Blunkett, who was the old Labour Education Secretary.
He was for
a while anyway. And he was, like, when he was in charge of Sheffield Council, Sheffield Council was famed for being one of the kind of the loony left councils in the 80s, and he was told about some of the, like, the strange things that the far left got up to in that kind of era, and one of them was a group of people called the Situationists, whose method was to go into a public place in gangs and basically strike poses and form tableau that people in the street could come past, and this would raise consciousness and awareness of their kind of, you know, the inherent impression of the system, and thereby bring about revolution more quickly. But actually it was just a bunch of weird people standing around on streets striking poses. But you're not the only one to have car dramas, given that my car is marooned 250 miles away in a garage feeling rather unwell. Mm-hmm. Oh dear. Yeah, so I had to, my car disgraced itself, funnily enough, straight after a service, and then I had to get towed and arrived at my workplace with my car in disgrace, and then had to get the train home. Mm-hmm. So frustrating. So hopefully that'll be fixed by now. But it's really frustrating to pay to have something put right. You're doing the right thing, you're getting it serviced, and then you get stung. That's that really? Oh, dear. Yeah. So, car dramas seems mm-hmm. to have been order of the week.
Yep.
News.
So it seems we got some good feedback from the last episode on New Orleans.
Yes, it was one person's favourite episode, apparently.
Favourite episode
Eva's
ever.
Eva's favourite episode.
Oh, excellent.
And she's American.
Right.
Apparently we only pronounced two things wrong.
Well, one of which was...
FEMA.
FEMA?
Or something.
FEMA.
FEMA.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, right? FEMA. I can remember first learning about them from the X-Files.
All right.
Yeah, because aren't they sort of like when the conspiracy theory stuff really got going in the X-Files? So it's interesting, though, because that kind of conflict between British and American pronunciation, because I've just recently been listening to, on your recommendation, the History of Rome podcast, which, if anybody's interested in ancient history, it's fabulous. Go listen to it. But every single pronunciation that he could have taken he's an American presenter and he's excellent, but if he could have taken the opposite way to the way a British person would pronounce it, he did it. And it was amazing, the consistency, the number of times, and I was listening to that, I was going, why have you gone for that vowel sound? That makes no sense. And he gets corrected a few times, but the best one that made me laugh out loud was the Roman governor of Britain, where he says Agricola, like that's clearly Agricola,
right?
Like Agricola. How could you look at that word and see Agricola? I don't know. It baffles me.
I think I could.
Oh, I don't know.
But it's I have a problem with hyperbole. That word says hyperbole.
It does not say hyperbole. Yeah.
And you don't say hyperbolic. You say hyperbolic.
Hyperbolic. No, isn't hyperbolic something entirely different?
I don't know. Must be spelled the same. But it's not hyperbole.
Yeah.
That's just pompous pronunciation.
Well, that was one of those words which I read a number of times without really knowing how it was pronounced. Now, I wanted to use it a few times and then chickened out. Funny enough, the first person I ever heard pronounce this out loud was David Blunkett at the Dispatch Box in the House of Parliament. Weirdly circular. This conversation is. And I went, hyperbole? Really? So obviously we have the same sort of thing. Mm. Yeah. So we got some good feedback and we continue to get some downloads from around the world as well. So
Mexico.
From our pals in Mexico and Finland and Spain.
Yes. And Japan.
Mm. So welcome aboard to all of those listeners. Assuming you didn't just download and listen to 10 for 10 seconds.
And go, what is this noise?
What are they talking about?
And if you have listened,
please get in touch.
And please rate us.
Yeah, please like, rate, and subscribe. Mm-hmm. No, but particularly, is it reviews on iTunes?
Reviews on iTunes would be good. This week's episode is about exoplanets. The first exoplanet discovery.
The 9th of January 1992 was kind of the announcement of the first confirmed, or sighting's the wrong word, observations.
Yeah, observation. Observation.
It's that way. You look at something and swerve around it and go, nope, yeah. Not for me.
I'll just swerve the light beams around that thing.
Yeah. Well, that's gravitational lensing, isn't it? Anyway, we'll get to that. This is by two chaps. Now, I'm going to let you pronounce his name, Alex.
Given that I failed with it earlier. Alexander Wolczan.
Wolczan, which is a Polish name. And who's the other fella?
Dale Frail. Which is a much easier name, but equally unbelievable, really.
Yeah, that's strange. But anyway, so and they were based at the
Arecibo
Radio Observatory. There's a famous image that comes with that announcement, isn't it? Wasn't it a group of three planet air stars with some red dots next to it, and they go, these were the first planets that were sort of observed. And I can remember that being announced on telly. I don't know whether maybe it was a science program or maybe it was a news program at the time. But I can remember being really excited by it. I mean, I would be sort of 11 years old at that point,
right.
But sort of I was all really into that kind of science and things anyway, and just going wow, but also feeling really like, what's the word, vindicated in a way, because my thought was always, well, there's that many stars about,
yeah, there must be planets, how can there not be
planets? Can there not be planets, like the universe is a big place, right? Yeah. But that's kind of reflected in the history of this, isn't it? Because like, who's
So, as always, we've just sort of said, well, this is the first confirmed planet.
Uh-huh.
And we said, well, that's our date, that's our starting point. But like with so many things of old news, it's hazy, it's more complicated than just one day. Because there were several discoveries for several observations earlier than that. The first scientific detection of a planet, of an exoplanet, was in 1988. Around Gamma Cephei AB. You will find some of the
astronomical names.
Yes. I didn't mention this in the planning, but I've got a little bit about their naming methods.
Right, okay.
It wasn't confirmed because it was around a binary star system.
Right, okay.
And they had used the observing the orbit of these two stars around each other and the way they sort of didn't quite match what they should have been.
All right, because so that was an indication. In a binary system, you've got two stars rotating around a centre.
Yeah.
And so they saw that centre was sort of...
Wasn't quite right.
Yeah, it was wobbling, I suppose, in a way, wasn't it? Yeah. And that's because you've got the action of this planet going around it as well. So you've actually got more objects rotating around a centre.
But because it was a binary system, it was thought that it could be unstable anyway. Binary systems aren't, with everything, it's not as simple as that. But in 2002, it was confirmed that there was actually a planet there. It was confirmed through other measuring means.
All right, so in 1988, we don't have the technology or the, you know, the theory to really explain what's happening. So it's sort of...
It's observed, but it can't be confirmed, so it doesn't count.
Right. That must really suck to be those scientists who think they're onto something and don't quite get the credit.
Yeah.
But isn't there an earlier observation in 1982? I read that.
Oh, I didn't get that. 1982.
Yeah. There is an earlier one, which I think is a lot more speculative, but again, they didn't have the, I think, kind of the engineering. The technology to really kind of sense these things wasn't really sort of up to it. Right. But again, that has been confirmed. Yeah. So.
There was one in 1989 as well, around HD114762B. Oh, hang on, no, that's the name of the planet.
That's the planet.
Around H2114762A.
The
planet is B. But that was originally classified as being a brown dwarf star. Orbiting another star.
All right, so it's a big lump of hydrogen, right?
It's a planet 11 times the mass of Jupiter.
Right, and Jupiter's quite big.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it has since been reclassified as an exoplanet rather than brown dwarf is essentially a dead star or a star that hasn't quite ignited because it's not quite massive enough, like a failed star.
Yeah. But speculation about this, you know, that in the same way that I, as a kid, just thought the universe is quite big, there must be planets out there. Speculation about this has gone back a lot further.
It's gone back to ancient times, really. People have had that sort of theory. A man called William Stephen Jacob, working in the East India Company's Madras Observatory, which I found great that the East India Company had its own observatory.
Well, I suppose it's easy to forget that the East India Company was largely like a state.
Yeah.
It was the British
corporate state.
It was the British state overseas for a long time.
Yeah.
And presumably navigation was important for them. So hence having an observatory.
He thought he'd, in 1855, he thought he'd found a planet around 70 Ophiuchi.
Oh, that's easily pronounced.
Might this have been a bad subject? A Dutch man called Peter van der Kamp claimed he discovered a planet round Barnard's star. This was all based on observing where the stars were, very accurately recording where they were and watching their movement in the sky.
Right.
And realising it didn't seem to be quite right.
Okay.
They've both been proven to be erroneous, unfortunately.
It should be interesting if there was one of those ancient claims or old claims that got confirmed.
Old news.
To complicate the story even a little bit further, there's another announcement in 1995, isn't there?
Yeah, the first planet discovered round a main sequence star.
So a main sequence would be a star, would that be like our own?
An Earth-like star, so a star that's kind of in the middle of its life.
Well, a sun-like star.
Yes, what did I say, an
Earth-like star?
when the Earth ignites in a few years it's when like, Trump has his way.
Yeah, after we've burned all the coal,
Yeah, so it's like a sun-like star. This particular one is 24% larger than the sun. So
the star is a big star.
It's
right.
a big star, but it's that's not stupidly large. I
suppose compared to some of the enormous hyperstars or whatever they're called.
That's close enough to be considered sun-like.
Yeah.
It's got a planet going around it. It's a giant planet, kind of, again, in the region of sort of Jupiter thing. But its year lasts 4 Earth days.
Right, so that's really quite nippy.
That's hurtling at some pace.
That's really going round, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I suppose this is the nature of the thing, that the closer in you are, the quicker you sort of rotate round, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that must be really hot there.
Yeah.
You think the weather's been warm over the weekend?
Old news.
But what's interesting is the real sort of drive is, I think, everybody wants to find Earth.
And yeah, another Earth.
Yeah, yes. isn't it, when you read so much about this, even at the very early stages, you know, I remember sort of reading in the news and science magazines and things when I was at college that everybody always wanted to talk about Earth-like stars, and so the race was on at that point. You know, to like once we're past this sort of period in the early 90s, there's a whole load of sort of science efforts and missions into space are launched. To then go and observe. So which is the first one you have down there? So
the first mission. Can you tell I've done some research this week?
David has
as he turns the page. Because it's interesting. I do my research in a notebook with pencil. Yeah, I'm doing a podcast using all kinds of technological equipment, but my notes are written in pencil.
I've always said the best thing about paper notes and paper books is you can keep your finger stuck in the page and go look at another page.
Yeah.
That is so difficult to do on electronic formats. Anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah,
wind over.
So, again, another hard thing to pronounce. I have no idea. So, it was an ESA mission, an ESA, European Space Agency.
Yeah.
In cooperation, that's the word. Yeah. In cooperation with CNES, the French space agency.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, so despite France being a member of ESA, it's partnered with them. Okay.
Yeah. It was called CORO. The letters are capital C, lowercase o, capital R, lowercase o, T. Was launched in 2006. First planet was called Korot 1b.
Right. And that B distinction says something about the naming convention here, isn't it? Which I find bizarre because they talk about a planetary system. So they have the name of the star.
Is the A.
And then it has the letter A. Mm-hmm. And then the first planet is the letter B.
But it becomes even more confusing because they're named in order of discovery, unless more than one planet is found at the same time.
And then it's from the inside out.
So you're going to have, once we start flying to the stars, some of the planetary systems are either going to need to be rejigged. Yeah. Or it's going to be just very confusing about where the A's and B's and C's are.
Trust like humans' ability to adopt multiple systems and just have done with this, right? But this drives me mad. Surely wasn't the logical thing to have a star Alfred the star, and then Alfred A, B, C, D being the planets?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Does that make sense to you? That would make sense to me, but anyway. So how successful is that?
I mean, as typical with the ESA, their website and so on just aren't quite as good as the NASA ones.
Right.
So, obviously, this mission came to an end a while ago, and it had found 32 confirmed exoplanets with 100 candidates.
That just goes to show, from one detection confirmed in 1992, very quickly those numbers are starting to expand, aren't they, to 32.
Yeah.
Plus another 100 potentials.
Yeah. And I don't know how many of those candidate discoveries have now become confirmed.
Confirmed, yeah.
Because the thing with the ESA websites is it'll tell you all kinds of things about the science that they did, all the weird and wonderful stuff that the normal layman doesn't understand. Uh-huh. But if you just want to know how many planets did it find, you can't.
What was the outcome?
Whereas the NASA website, it's, we found 3,000 planets! But what science did you do? Oh, we did some science.
Yeah, you sort of click through and eventually you'll find all the small print.
The ESA, as with everything European, they're rubbish at getting the word out there.
Yeah, that's right.
Public relations isn't as good.
On a very similar note, one thing that always irritates me is how poor NASA TV is.
Right.
Like, whenever they're covering launches of spacecraft and things.
How dry, and
their commentary's terrible. And for some reason, whoever does their commentary obviously has some other job they have to do, because all their commentary is at least 30 seconds delayed behind what's actually happening. I'm exaggerating, it's always delayed and it just drives you around the bend. Whereas you look at SpaceX, if you watch their coverage of any launch, it's all just like, it's all very slick and commercial and. Yeah. People who understand what they're doing have dedicated jobs to do that thing, and they narrate it as the thing happens, and you understand what's going on.
You do wonder, why doesn't NASA have a a decent PR
department. A good PR department, yeah. They seemed like that. I remember that watching one of the last space shuttle landings, and the shuttle came down, and they would declare touchdown, and then nose gear touchdown. And the shuttle landed, it went on to all three wheels, and then eventually he said, touchdown, and then we'll wait a little bit, go for a cup of tea. Nose gear touchdowns. Like, that happened 30 seconds ago. Why are you even bothering to provide a narration, a commentary here? It's pointless. Anyway, that's totally aside to the main point. So, and then that's followed up by the Kepler mission, which is the main star of the show, really. Here, yes, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Kepler's sort of thing was to kind of sit and stare at a very kind of
relatively small part
small patch.
Space, yes. Yeah, so that was launched on the 7th of March 2009 with a planned life of only 3.5 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It got extended. That planned life was extended for a little while, but was knackered by the fact that it started to fail fairly early on.
Right. Because it had problems with the gyroscopes that are inside of the thing that are designed to steer it so it can point at a certain amount of sky and stay stable.
I suppose
they
should
started to fail.
Should explain that it's essentially a space telescope, space observatory, just in case people are wondering what this thing looks like. It's a giant telescope in the sky.
And it was really concerned about just staring at stars and then seeing if those stars dimmed. So, which leads us a little bit into sort of how that the main way of detecting these things, isn't it? Because the observation in 92 is very different, isn't it? That's a sort of a radio observation. And whereas the observation from Kepler is all about looking at the light that's coming from the star, seeing how brilliant it is.
Yeah.
And then waiting for a planet to pass in front of it, and that blots out a certain amount of the light, and so you get this sort of this dip, and then obviously as the planet emerges from the other side and goes around the back again, you know, you can go then go, all right, there we go. And if it happens again, then you know there's like a you know the periodicity of the orbit, if that, the orbit. And one of the things I was reading about that is apparently in some ways, despite its kind of limited lifespan, Kepler has been a bit of a victim of its own success. It's created just this vast back catalogue of data. And also they've got how many planets did they confirm?
So over 3,000.
It's over 3,000, wasn't it? And so what started out as one observation has now, the floodgates are really open, aren't they? And there's just this vast, vast sort of catalogue of data. And I mean, there's not just the ones where they're confirmed. There's a whole running into the thousands of candidates where you might need like second observations and things to confirm it. And I just find that remarkable, you know, something that when I was a kid, like, we're the only planets, you know. And I remember people sort of declaring, it's just us, we're all alone.
That always just seemed a strange thing to say. It's just us, especially when scientists said it. They had no evidence. Well, I suppose there was no evidence to say that there is other planets. But they had no evidence the other way to.
Yeah, and like the negative, when scientists say negative things that like that, often they seem to go unchallenged at the time.
Yeah,
you know, because if you say, well, it seems reasonable to me that were a star with a planetary system, there might be others. You instantly get accused of being unscientific and speculating. Well, yes, it's speculating, but it's not unreasonable.
It's not unreasonable, and it's no less speculative.
To me, like, exceptionism seems less reasonable, much less reasonable to say that we're somehow unique. But now the floodgates open, so but obviously the mechanical failure on Kepler really sort of holds it back.
Yeah, so they had to, basically they couldn't continue. Basically what happened, these
gyroscopes.
They keep calling them reaction wheels for some
reason. Well, they are reaction wheels, actually, because they're not just for stabilisation. The reaction wheels, because you can run them at different speeds,
and that allows you to turn.
And it allows you to turn it, because so you get the forces.
Because these reaction wheels fail, they can no longer aim the telescope correctly.
Mm.
So they had to change the mission. They had to invent a new mission for it, essentially.
Right.
Because it's still all the sciencey stuff inside worked.
Right, the instruments and the
instruments. They just couldn't move it properly. So they had to start. What they changed it to was looking for planets around red dwarf stars.
Right.
And that drastically reduced the number it found. So it went down from, you know, finding 3,000 or so to just 300 or so planets. So that the number it was finding just drops off a cliff.
Yeah.
I mean, still quite a few.
But while it's still going, that'll just drip, drip, drip until eventually the thing dies a death, you know, as all these bits of machinery do. I mean, as long as the funding lasts, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
Our news.
And so I picked up the story here because I was looking at that has sort of come to a bit of a natural ending in a way. And what's the successor to it? Because assuming that this is now quite a sexy piece of...
Just so people don't think David's research was crap, I've just found where I wrote the proper number of planets.
Oh, go on.
3,610.
Right, there we go.
I did have it written down. I haven't just Googled it. I've got it there.
Yeah, yeah. And so we've got the successor mission is TESS, which is a lot easier to pronounce.
Yes.
I get easy pronunciations. It's the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. In the article I was reading, which was sort of saying that Kepler has this enormous catalogue, but it suffers from this problem because it has looked long and deep, but into a very narrow patch of sky. That's been good for the statistics, just getting a view on broadly how many stars have planetary systems, and kind of giving that kind of broader insight, if that makes sense. Whereas now they want to look at smaller stars and cooler stars, and like smaller and cooler than the sun, and they're going to concentrate on those with the TESS mission. And hopefully then, because they're saying that the beauty of looking at stars that are smaller and cooler is that you can more easily characterize the nature of the planet.
Right, so you can see whether it's Earth-like or...
Yeah, and of course now they're starting to look at not only just as that transiting, not only the dip, but also the changes in the spectra.
So they can see what the planet's made out of.
Yeah, what's the planet made of, or the atmosphere is made out of, as light refracts through. The sensitivity of that just blows me away. You talk about such small quantities of light, and they can still sort of, we've now got the technology to be able to discern that. That just blows me away. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. So, that's slated to launch March 2018, so that's not that far away. So this news story that keeps coming back over the last few years... It's going to come back again. Yeah.
And of course, one thing I read in relation to that was the James Webb Space Telescope will be going up shortly after,
right,
which is the replacement for Hubble.
Right.
And they're going to use TESS to feed information to the James Webb.
Right.
And say, oh, look at this candidate. Yeah. And possibly because the James Webb Telescope is going to be so much more sensitive than the Hubble. I mean, the Hubble's amazing, but the James Webb's going to be infinitely better. Possibly get decent imagery of some of these places.
James Webb Space Telescope is going to be purely in the infrared, isn't
right,
it?
Yeah.
And the article I was reading is that they're hoping to cooperate with the Giant Magellan Telescope and the 30-meter telescope, which are Chile and Hawaii's, and they're both sort of quite new instruments as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so presumably, I think they are optical. They're in the visible light spectrum. So you're going to have all of these brand new enormous bits of gear all
trying
operating
to image these.
Trying to image these, or at least I don't think will we image the planets, or will we just infer from data what the nature of these planets?
We have sort of images of planets already in infrared, and they're very poor in
the sort of dots.
They're like a pixel next to a big mass of other pixels, and that's using past technology. So I imagine we might get a few. Yes, you're not going to be able to go, oh god, they've built an Empire State Building style thing. Oh, hang on, there's the Great Wall of not China.
China, yeah. Canals.
Yeah. There's a face on that there planet.
Oh dear. Yeah, so it is exciting though, isn't it? That this enormous number of planets that we've got so far, which is running between 3,000 and 4,000, is now going to explode again quite soon.
Yeah.
With all these observations. And obviously people working to then, confirm the candidates that we've already got in the existing data. And I think one of the things which we haven't really spoken about here is that with this method of waiting for planets to transit in front of a star, you don't see the planets that are just going around a star.
Yeah, because that relies on planets that orbital planes facing us.
Yeah, they're edge on, like looking at a plate, edge on looking at the system in that profile.
How many stars have their orbital planes the other way, so the planets aren't coming in front of their star?
I mean, there is a load of other methods for detection as well, isn't there? Which you've got a load of which some of it we understand and some of it we don't. What was the one which we really had no clue?
The one that made me really chuckle. I don't know if Russell went to look for this afterwards.
I looked at it, but didn't really discern much.
Relativistic beaming, and my note says WTF. Something to do with beaming observed flux. And the Doppler effect. Well, I know what the Doppler effect is. Don't know what flux. Beaming flux is.
Flux? What type of flux? Magnetic flux? That makes no sense.
Yeah. But essentially, I sat and I thought, oh, I'll take a note of the different methods, not realising just how many there were. So yeah. I ended up with a mess. I didn't give up. But don't worry, I'm not going to read through them.
Yeah, but there's like, how many? 6 or 7?
14.
Right.
14 different methods.
And so presumably when you're confirming the existence of these planets, you might be looking at using multiple methods.
Exactly.
Or,
that's how you confirm that there's something there. Yeah. You use one method and then you use another one, yeah.
It wasn't just a boot of dust that floated in front of you when you took the...
Well, exactly. I mean, that's what the problem with that method we've been talking about there, about the planet going in front of the star. Well, how do you know it's not a dust cloud that's gone past in space? Yeah. Or even just a cloud on Earth?
And just think about the time of orbits as well. You know, if you were to be far away looking at Earth, you know, it's going to take quite some time before you...
Yeah, I mean...
Notice it's going to take you at least 365 days to see it again.
Yeah, I mean...
And the orbits of things like Jupiter around our system is far, far, far longer.
I mean, one of the reasons Kepler's mission was planned to be that 3.5 years was because they wanted to try and get 3 observations of each candidate.
Right.
Obviously, something with a longer period isn't going to get that 3.
Right, yeah. So your candidates... I wonder how many of these candidates in the data are just where there's one observation.
Yeah.
And so they're waiting for a later date. But you have to sit and stare at these things. It must be... Yeah, like a blink of an eye.
Well, I don't suppose there's like a bunch of sort of Chinese 7-year-olds all just sitting watching screens. Oh, that's gone dark. Press the button. Yeah.
What I like about this, and I think to move the sort of the conversation on, is
from Chinese 7-year-olds.
I think the reason why this always ignites the press, because in some ways, some of this is quite dry, isn't it? And not, it's not new anymore. We've seen it before.
Yeah.
But every time it comes into the press, it's always about Earth-like planets. And then if it's not Earth-like planets or planets of a similar size, it's planets in the habitable zone around stars. Because it's this tantalising thing, isn't it, about is there life out there?
Should we explain the habitable zone?
We can do. Current thinking is all about the existence of liquid water.
Mm-hmm.
On the planet being vital for life, or at least for life that is similar to ours. And so if you've got a star of a certain amount of hotness, there's going to be a kind of a ring of orbits around that star which has temperatures whereby a planet could maintain liquid water, and hence therefore, you know, potential for life. There was an excellent article I was reading a little while ago about the effect of geological systems on the ability to regulate the temperatures on a planet, and she was saying that it's much greater than previously thought. And so the upshot of that is the breadth of habitable zones around stars might be a lot larger than first thought. So what could be quite a narrow strip around a star where stars could actually be a lot larger. So where we found, and just recently there was that announcement, wasn't there, of planetary system of, was it 6 planets?
Yes.
Around and one star. That a good chunk of them are in the habitable zone, but there's 1 or 2 of them might be in this broader habitable zone that she was proposing.
Right.
So the chances for Earth-like stars, and I'm using air quotes, which doesn't work on...
Sun-like stars.
Sun-like stars.
You were both making that mistake. Earth-like planets around sun-like stars. Earth-like planets
around stars is, you know, potentially a lot larger than was first thought. Yeah. And that's really exciting, isn't it? You know, I don't know, I think there's a certain amount of romance in this. I think the romance is this stretch back in the early days of humanity, isn't it, of literally looking up at the stars and thinking, what's up there? What is up there? And the next question I think is, are we alone? Which, I mean, to sort of go philosophical for a minute, I think it's kind of like how you relate to other people and then the world around you, and then that bit that surrounds the world, you know, the stars you see in the sky. I think that's a very basic human want to inquire about that.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how much of that, despite it being sort of a bit airy-fairy, is what ignites this news story over and over again.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is.
Yeah, because I think it's just a... And I find it exciting that we're living in a time that these questions are starting to be answered, that we might eventually see a planet that goes, look, that's very much like us, or so similar to us, you know. And then there's this exciting thing of, well, there might be whole families of planets that are similar. I mean, they talk about planets that are 10 times as large as us, maybe still being able to support life. I think the gravity on there must be enormous.
Yeah, by our standards.
I mean, so they must have really big bones.
or just be tiny.
Yeah, or tiny, or they're all pancake-shaped. I know, it is so strange, isn't it? It's strange to think. Maybe it's the real aquatic species.
Old news.
One of the things which I thought people might enjoy sort of going over is the Fermi paradox, which is that something you've heard of before?
It's something I've heard of.
Right, so Enrico Fermi, one of the very famous physicists of, you know, the early 20th century, he was having lunch with one or two of the other big names. Edward Teller, I think, was there, you know, who invented the hydrogen bomb. He just asked, where are they? Which is a very good question, right? Because if there is so many stars, and so just to quickly sort of run through, they're talking about in the Milky Way, there's 200 to 400 billion stars, and in the observable universe, there's 70 sextillion. I mean, that's the number of stars, right? So the number of planets must be vast, just vast out there. And so if you've got these number of stars that are like the sun, and you've got some of those stars are a lot older than our sun as well. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of appeared in the sequence a lot earlier. And so presumably some of those planets are Earth-like. Some will have intelligent life, and some will have civilizations which have interstellar travel or will communicate in some way, send out signals that are detectable. Then even given like a slow pace of travel, which we can achieve with our technology now, you know, you could get across the Milky Way in about a million years, which on the scheme of things, a million years is not a huge amount of time. Sort of in geological time.
Yeah.
Never mind like cosmic time. Yeah. You know. So the question is, why can't we see them? Why can't we hear them? Why aren't they here? Why haven't they come to visit? And I don't know where you stand on, just sort of instinctively.
Instinctively, I just think we haven't had technology that can listen to it for long enough to have picked up this information. But just recently I was thinking there's a bit of an argument about whether we should try and communicate with them.
Yeah, whether...
Because if they're aggressive and we say, hello...
Yeah.
They might turn up with battleships and blow to smithereens. Yeah. If we're having that conversation, so are they.
They're having the same.
Yeah. They don't know who we are.
So I want to quickly run through some of the proposed sort of solutions to this. Right. And I want you to just sort of go yes or no, whether you find it attractive or not.
Can I go, and...
Right. Extraterrestrial life is rare or non-existent. No, I don't think that's true. No other intelligent life has arisen.
Maybe.
Possibly, yeah, you never know.
Yeah, we might.
But then human exceptionalism. Aliens lack advanced technology. They might be the same place that we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, could possibly
be. That's reasonable.
Intelligent life always destroys itself.
No, that's just too negative. That's assuming all life is the same as us.
Yeah, but I mean, intelligence, well, you'd have to argue really about what intelligence is, and does intelligence always do the same thing? Intelligent life always destroys others. So maybe there is a civilization out there that just goes eat people, and that's why we never hear from anything else, because they just keep getting eaten
maybe
by somebody else.
It's possible, but again, it seems a bit too
human-like. To go around doing that. Yeah. Periodic extinction by natural events.
Well, yes,
they get destroyed before
that is
going to
happen. That is going to happen, but would it happen to all of them if there is, you know, millions and millions or billions?
Well, it depends
it
on
can't
the
happen to all of them.
Depends on the frequency of those events, just broadly in the universe, doesn't it? So this is a bizarre one. Inflation theory and the youngness of the universe, right? And talking about inflation is about this idea that there are like multiple universes being generated all of the time.
Okay.
As a consequence of the Big Bang. I don't quite understand the reasoning, but it says that every universe probably just has one intelligent life form in it. Just by the sort of the distribution of chances and things. But they're talking about there are e to the 10 to the 37 universes per second created, which is just an astonishing quantity of universes.
Who thought you'd be saying that sentence on a podcast? An astonishing quantity of universes.
I only had half a dozen this morning. Now
I've got E to the 27.
E to the 10 to the 37 of them. I'm literally up to here.
My carrier bag splitting.
But I don't really understand that. Like, I don't understand the physics. I don't understand the logic and the probability in that. That's very, very strange. Where are we? Intelligent life is too far apart in space or time. I think there's something in that. I find that attractive. There might be plenty of civilizations out there, but they're just too far away.
Yes, too far away and in time as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
That they may have come and gone.
Yep.
In a galaxy far, far away, a long time ago, right? Are we going to have to pay royalties on that? It's too expensive to travel in space. I think that might be true as well. Because there's always this thing about, they might have technologies which are far better than ours. They're kind of bounded by the same rules as us.
Yeah, bounded by the same physics.
Yeah, and although like their language of expressing mathematics and things might be different,
it'll still be expressing the same things.
The same things, yeah. I'm not convinced we can, you know, the Star Trek thing of just inventing tachyon beams because, you know, humans haven't existed for long enough.
I think that's reasonable.
Yeah. Humans are not listening properly.
That's reasonable.
Yeah, we're not listening to the right things. Only detectable for a short period. So, like, we might have technology which broadcasts radio signals and things, but after a little while, that technology might become obsolete. And we move on to other forms of communication, so there'll only be a very brief period where we are detectable. And then these other civilizations are the same. And just to quickly run through the rest, civilizations tend to isolate themselves.
But
you just said that we're concerned about communication and that it might be a bad idea.
True.
So we're isolating ourselves in a way. They're too alien, and therefore we just don't know what it is we're looking for.
That's a possibility.
That is quite true. Everybody's listening and not transmitting.
Yes.
Yeah. The Earth is a zoo, and we're being allowed to develop at our own pace.
No. I mean, I can see what they're saying.
Yeah.
I can see what they're saying, but again, that's human exceptionalism, I think.
Perhaps. So then there's the Earth is a planetarium, where the observable universe is actually a simulated reality.
Not this thing again.
Well, you know, they could build that into the system that we look as though we're alone. It's too dangerous to communicate, which again, I think is, like anybody who does gets eaten alive. All of reality is a simulation.
Yeah.
That sounds like a catch-all explanation to all kinds of things.
To me, it's very nihilistic. There's no difference between that and religion. It's just techno-religion. That's all that is.
Yeah, it is. They are here and they are undetected.
Well, yes.
Maybe.
X-Files,
yeah.
Lizard people.
Ah, no, they're undetected. So no, they are here, but nobody knows that they're here. They could easily be observing us, but they have technology such that we can't perceive them. But that seems like God, in a way.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Sort of like kind of one of those...
It's not much different to the zoo theory, really.
Yeah, and the last one is they are here, but unacknowledged, which is the lizard people.
Yes.
Etc.
David Icke.
Yeah, but thank you to Wikipedia for that. There's an extraordinarily long article where all of these things are sort of enumerated. But I thought that list amused me because there was a load of things where I go, oh, yeah. And the rest of them, like, this is crazy. This can't possibly be the case. But I think it's interesting. We have sent messages out, haven't we, from the Arecibo
dish.
But they did it in 1974 on the 16th of November. And there's like a sort of this burst of information. And the same debate here is had around the golden plaque we sent on Voyager 1 and the golden record disc that we sent on Voyager 2, you know, this sort of message.
Yeah.
It's always debated as to whether these messages are, like, decipherable.
Mm-hmm.
And so there the radio message was sort of a burst of data, and it had to be arranged in a rectangle of 23 by 73, you know, and then you would have to know that these are numbers across the top, then these are the structure of DNA and things was encoded,
right.
And then, you know, there was a picture of a man and then a picture of the radio dish.
To me, I think they overthought a lot of that. I think any intelligent life is likely to be able to decipher stuff. So if you think about us trying to decipher hieroglyphics, it took us a long, long time. Well, we had to find a
Rosetta Stone.
But we had been able to decipher. We can decipher codes and things like
but
that.
But we can't decipher things like Linear B.
That's a good point. It's a good point.
Because the problem is with Linear A and Linear B, didn't Linear A, we eventually found some sort of link to something else, didn't we?
Yeah.
Whereas the other, we didn't. And to me, like the record disc we sent on Voyager, that we've got recordings of music, I think, might be sort of more meaningful in a way. Because it's obviously artificial. It's not just background hiss. You know, you'd be able to discern and then go, oh, well, there's a series of harmonies of sounds.
Different
frequencies that somebody has arranged in a way that is unusual.
Yeah, and there's a rhythm to it.
Regular
rhythm.
Yeah. So, I might be then ascribing aliens the ability to appreciate art, which again might be being sort of anthropocentric.
I can imagine them not like perceiving it as art, but it being able to perceive it as being artificial.
Yeah, whereas there is a load of recordings of people saying greetings from Earth, isn't there, or very, very similar sort of thing, and it's in dozens and dozens of languages, and that to me just seems meaningless because it will sound very different from one thing to the other, even though it's the same meaning, and they're not going to have a Rosetta Stone.
Yeah.
And so essentially all we're doing is sending Linear B, and to me so much of that is about us, isn't it? It's about we're doing it for us, we're not doing it for them.
Old news.
I mean, one thing I find fascinating is that we still can't really describe what went on was the WOW signal, which was August the 15th, 1977, at the Ohio State Big Ear. So this is one of the sort of fairly basic sort of radio astronomy instruments at the time, you know, and they just got this enormous signal from like outside of the background level of noise on the radio signal. And the reason why it's called the WOW signal is because
circled and wrote the word WOW.
They wrote the word WOW with the margins. And we still can't explain that. Although we've looked. Yeah. We've looked again at that patch of the sky. Well, it's actually two patches of the sky because the instrument had like two horns gathering radio signals. So they reckon they know where these two patches are, but we've looked 50 different times and still not heard it again.
Old news.
You were talking a little bit earlier on about the effect of finding planets and life outside of the solar system on humans.
On humanity,
religion.
Well, I think that's the other topic, which I think it fascinates me because that very basic question of are we alone? I think very quickly when we start to discover these planets, like the next question is very obvious. It's like, if we're not alone, how do we feel about it?
Mm-hmm.
I'd recommend everybody to go find. There's a we'll find the link and put it in the notes. There's a BBC Future article about it. BBC Future, to British listeners who might not be familiar, is one of the commercial bits of the BBC and more easily accessible from outside of the UK. And they have an excellent article about like what religious response might be to the discovery of intelligent life elsewhere. And there's an excellent bit which I looked up because I remember it sort of being in the press about Pope Benedict in 2010 was asked, would he baptize an alien? And he said, he said yes.
Right.
And Pope Francis was making quite a detailed speech about acceptance, about the role of the church to be open and welcoming to all comers, which is kind of one of the key teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. And he extended that argument to its far point and said, you know, if aliens do want to be baptized, who are we to close doors?
Right.
Which I think is interesting because that is a logical extension of the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth that I won't object to, because to me it just seems quite obvious. I harbour a doubt about this. It's very earth-centric, isn't it? That our religions would be
the right religion.
The right ones.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
But all religions say that, don't they? All religions say our religion is the right religion.
It fascinates me that people could then extend it so far.
Yeah.
Knowing how big the universe is. Built in that comment, you can read my own personal opinions on forms of religion in some way. I think I would have time for... there are, in that article that I was talking about from the BBC, there's a Jewish commentator talking about when he's a rabbi talking about him being a Jew and having a Jewish faith with God, but God would exist everywhere and other sort of intelligences would have their own relationship with God. It's still the same God. That is at least logically consistent.
Yeah.
And I can see why a Jewish a person from a Jewish faith would take that view, because they're unusually then they're not an evangelical religion. You know, that's a religion which you have to seek to gain acceptance. You know, you kind of move in, as it were, and it takes a certain amount of effort to do so. Whereas, you know, I think Christianity, Islam, the other sort of major world religions are to some extent evangelical.
Yeah.
I don't know, is Sikhism... I'm not convinced Sikhism is.
No, it's Hinduism isn't really either.
Yeah, there are elements of it that are like all religions are quite chauvinist and sort of want to impose it upon populations locally. But anyway, that's a whole other debate, I guess. But I think it's fascinating that that's one really key aspect of humanity, whether we believe in religion or not. Whatever, whether you're a man of faith or a woman of faith or not, or a person of faith or not, that's one aspect that very quickly becomes challenged. And the moment we do discover a signal, I would love to think that the Star Trek thing is true, that we discover alien life forms and it brings humanity together.
Yeah.
We put aside our differences, we realise that we're not alone and that we're a very small group of people in comparison to the universe out there. But I just know that that isn't the case. They just become another form of other. I don't know, I'm a real pessimist on this.
And there'll be a real split between how we treat them.
Yeah, because if they come, we come in peace for all of Vulcan kind or whatever it is. There'll be some people wanting to roll out the red carpet, and there'll be others that...
Yeah, lock the gates. No. Build the wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need a space wall!
Be a good wall.
Be a great wall. Be the best wall.
We need a Dyson sphere.
Old news.
So if you've enjoyed that episode of Old News, you can get in touch with us lots of different ways. You can go to our website, www.oldnews.podbean.com.
You can also email us at oldnewspod@gmail.com.
You can search for us on Facebook, just look for Old News Podcast.
And we're also available on the Twitters, @OldNewsPod.
And of course, you can look for us on YouTube.
Yay, we remembered YouTube. But just be warned that you will need a machete and possibly a safari suit and a pith helmet.
Yes.
Then you go searching through the wilds of YouTube and you will eventually find this at the bottom of a dark pit.
In a filing cabinet marked Beware of the Leopard.
We're going to have to pay...
Douglas Adams.
Yeah, so we're paying George Lucas and Douglas Adams for the roles.
And Gene Roddenberry.
Oh, yes, of course. At this point in the show, it's traditional to say thank you to the people that help in the production of Old News, including bensound.com for providing royalty-free music under Creative Commons license.
And, of course, Peter Kitson for letting us borrow his voice.
Old News.
Here at Old News Towers, we have a bit of a...
Such a cliche. Old News Towers.
That's why I did it. It's 15 big Old News Minutes past 10 o'clock.
It's Monday. It's the biggest podcast of the week. It's Old News.
Yes,
live from Chesley Street.
We have a list of topics we've been gathering since we started this. Some of the ones we wrote down on the very first day we still haven't done yet. But we'd love to have other topics suggested to us. Because we come up with the ideas, but we think we're not sure if people will like that.
And also I think some of the episodes we've done by suggestion have actually been some of our best episodes so far. So
yes, yeah.
Always willing to hear from listeners and, you know, is there something that you remember from the news that you want to sort of cover again and maybe we might have something to say about it. We'd also like to hear from our listeners, what podcasts do you listen to? Is there any podcast that you think that we might enjoy, but also... the listeners of Old News might enjoy as well. You know, podcasting's very much a community, a family, and we'd like to sort of please share your experiences and what you think we might appreciate.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. How long long's this recording session been? One of our longest.
Yeah, 1 hour 21 minutes.
Oh, it's a good job somebody else is doing the editing.